Well, it gives me very, very great pleasure to welcome Professor Chris Frith to College House. When we were both much younger, we were both looking at the same sort of brain potentials, something called the... the contingent negative variation. I know it extremely well, just lost it. The contingent negative variation was interesting to me because at that time I was appointed to Broadmoor and we were looking at the difference between groups of people who were psychopaths, normal controls, and people who had schizophrenia. The normal controls we took as the warders, well, the nurses, in fact, because Broadmoor to hospital, we took the nurses. And everybody used to tease me in saying, do you really think you're going to get a difference between the psychopaths and the nurses? Which was very unkind, because of course one did. And so at the same time, Chris was looking at the CNV, and it became one of the most interesting techniques for looking at what the nature of consciousness is. Now, Chris is Emeritus Professor of Neuropsychology at the Wellcome Centre for Neuroimaging at UCL. He's the Niels Bohr Visiting Professor in the Interacting Mind Project at the University of Aarhus in Denmark, and he's Fellow of All Souls College, Oxford. And he's worked mainly with the Medical Research Council. Of course, he's been elected a Fellow of the Royal Society. Chris is enormously eminent. But not only that, what I have enjoyed about Chris is his work and the quality of his work. It's been absolutely outstanding. And relating to the theory of mind, what goes on in schizophrenia and so on, Chris has been leading this. He has over 400 publications. Not in the sort of journals that I publish in, but in absolutely top-ranked journals. He's a most wonderful and creative scientist. And so I'm very pleased to welcome Chris to Collett, and he's going to say, what is consciousness for? Yes, Chris, what is it? So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'm basically an experimental psychologist or neuropsychologist, and a lot of this talk will consist of me describing my favorite experiments, not necessarily by me, and trying to demonstrate what they tell us about the nature of consciousness. And I think what is consciousness for is actually a much more interesting question than what is consciousness, because we might be able to answer the second one before we can answer the first one. And the reason for saying that goes back to Stuart Sutherland, who was a very eminent psychologist who founded the department in Sussex University. And he famously wrote, it is impossible to specify what it is, what it does, or why it evolved. Nothing worth reading has been written on it. And this is probably still largely true. So rather than starting with academic definitions of consciousness, I want to consider popular culture. And there's an interesting phenomenon that since the 19th century, the role of consciousness in the world, as it were, has steadily decreased, which I call the strange case of the devolving zombie. So we start with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which few have actually read. But what is striking about the monster in this story is that he has an exquisite sense of self and consciousness. And this is a quote. He said, who was I? What was I? Whence did I come? What was my destination? These questions continually recur, but I was unable to solve them. So at this time, giving someone life and giving them consciousness were all part of the same package. But 100 years later, when the famous film version of Frankenstein appeared, the monster still has vigorous life, but the consciousness has become much more dim. So that consciousness and life are no longer so closely linked. And then, of course, in the greatest zombie film of all times, what's it called? Dawn of the Dead, where you have the Frankenstein's monster has multiplied into a crowd of undead zombies who are besieging a shopping mall, and the only remains of consciousness that is left is a desire to shop. This is a quote from the film. What are they doing? Why do they come here? And he said, it's a kind of instinct. This is an important place in their lives. And if you want to read a serious academic article about this, you should look at the Critical Quarterly for 1992, the article, I Shopped with a Zombie. And meanwhile, in the academic world, David Chalmers, who's not actually a zombie, although one might be mistaken, invented the concept of the philosophical zombie. The idea being that this is a creature which is, who behaves exactly like us, and we wouldn't be able to tell the difference between this philosophical zombie and ourselves, but actually lacks conscious experience. And his argument is that you can't, there's nothing you can say about us that requires consciousness experience. So is it simply, it has no function, it's an epiphenomenon. So I don't believe this. I believe, I guess because I believe in evolution, that consciousness must achieve things that a creature without consciousness would not be able to achieve. Otherwise, why does the brain spend so much energy generating conscious experience? The problem is to try and demonstrate what these things are that consciousness enables us to do. What is it good for? And in fact, in parallel with the development of the zombie, neuroscience has revealed that consciousness has a remarkably small role, at least in the immediate control of our behaviour. And so by listing all the things that consciousness is not needed for, perhaps we can reveal its true role. So, for example, we have a vivid feeling of being in control of our actions. That's one important aspect of our conscious experience. We have an intention to do something, and then we do it. This is mind over matter, sometimes called mental causation. But many people think this is an illusion. Let me give you an example. So in that case, what's the point of it? But let me first give some examples of why it might be an illusion. This is an experiment from Marc Jeanneret's lab in Lyon, which is simply about reaching and grasping. So here's the subject, participant I should call him these days, on one side of the table, and here are three vertical perspex rods that light up, and your task is as soon as the rod lights up, you reach out and grab it. And there's a micro switch here that detects when you start to reach, and you can follow by putting lights on the hand the exact path of the movement, depending on which of the three rods you're going to reach. And on some trials, the middle rod lights up, but as soon as you move, it goes out and say rod number three lights up. And then, of course, you have this trajectory here. You start off going towards rod two, and then as soon as it changes, you switch to rod one, in this case. And you can measure precisely where your trajectory changed. So how long did it take you to change the trajectory after the rod one lit up? And they also asked, and the answer was about 110 milliseconds. So you very rapidly switched your movement to this other rod here. But they also asked the people to indicate when they saw the target change by calling out tan, because this was a French experiment. And that happened about 300 milliseconds after they had already changed the direction of movement of their hand. And in fact, it happened so late that on some trials, subjects would say, it was very strange, but I found my hand had already grasped the rod before I noticed it had moved. So this is an example of this very immediate control of action doesn't need conscious awareness. And in fact, you could say that's a jolly good thing because conscious awareness is too slow. This obviously applies to tennis players and batsmen in cricket. They have to be able to respond to the ball long before they're aware of where it is. But that's just a simple movement. What about making complicated decisions? Should I buy this beautiful but now trashed Mercedes SEC 420 or some other car? And at Dieksterhuis in Holland did an experiment on people making complicated real-life decisions like this. So they might be given a list of cars. In the simple case there, each car has four features which you have to take into account. In the difficult case, each car has 12 features that you have to take into account, and you're given 4 minutes to decide which car is the best one to buy. and they had some objective way of putting together the features that, so that they knew what the correct answer was. And they have two conditions here. One condition, subjects think about it for 4 minutes and then make their choice. The other condition, they have to do something else for 4 minutes that distracts them from thinking about it and then make their choice. And in the case of the difficult decision with 12 aspects, the people who were not allowed to think about it made the better decision. This is a slightly controversial result, but I like it very much. Again, it shows that we can make good decisions of this complicated kind better if we don't actually think about them. This may be because conscious experience is very bad at putting together multiple features. It tends to home in on a few, and you might home in on the wrong ones. And now we come to the famous Libet experiment, which uses something analogous to the CNV that Peter was talking about at the beginning. And the results of this experiment was that brain changes can be measured that seem to precede the conscious decision to act. And some philosophers have said, does this mean, therefore, that we have no free will? Or what I think it does is it demonstrates how the brain creates our experience of being in control. So this is the Libet experiment, and this is actually the right shaft potential or readiness potential. So subjects were told, you will sit in this room for half an hour, and every time you have the urge to do so, lift your index finger. That was the instruction. And it was well known that if you measure from the top of the head here, about 1 second prior to actually lifting your finger, there's an increase in negativity in the brain. And therefore, you can measure the start of the brain activity around here and the time that the movement actually occurred. That is what I call physical time. And Libet's innovation was to develop a method of asking people to indicate when they had the urge to move their finger, and also on other trials, when they actually lifted their finger. And I call this mental time. And the striking result was that the awareness of the urge to lift the finger happened about 300 milliseconds after there were changes in brain activity, which is interesting because it's similar time to what we saw in the reaching and grasping experiment I just showed you, where the change in the movement happens about 300 milliseconds before the awareness that you need to move. This has been replicated. I mean, people have criticized the details of this experiment, but it has been replicated many times, particularly by my colleague Patrick Haggard. Interestingly, and not often remembered, is that when you ask people when did they lift their finger, they actually report lifting it about 80 milliseconds before they actually lifted it. So this is in advance of the event. And I think this is an interesting clue. So here again, if you ask people about their awareness of having an urge to act, it doesn't seem to correspond to what's actually happening in the brain. But what you should notice is that the intention to lift the finger and the actual lifting of the finger are closer together in mental time. And this has been explored in much more detail by Patrick Haggard using a slightly different task. So here you press a button, and then a quarter of a second later, you hear a tone. So this is in physical time. You press the button here, the tone happens here. You then use the Libet technique to ask people, when did they press the button and when did they hear the tone? And you see the button pressing is experienced later in mental time than physical time, and the tone is experienced earlier. So again, the action you made and the consequence of it, the tone, are pulled together in mental time, which he calls intentional binding. It's in binding intentions to outcomes. And being a proper experimenter, he did a control for this. So he said, right, we're going to have an involuntary movement, which you can produce by giving a very strong magnetic pulse on the top of your head, which causes your finger to move. So you have an involuntary movement here, and then 250 milliseconds later, the tone occurs. And now you get the opposite of intentional binding. The involuntary movement is experienced as happening earlier than it did, and the tone is experienced as happening later than it did. So when the movement, it is not your intention to move and cause this tone, the action and its consequence are pulled apart in mental time, which confirms, I think, Patrick's idea that this is a form of intentional binding, that the brain connects your actions and their outcomes by making them appear to be closer together. And this is just a control where you sham TMS, which makes a loud click, but your finger doesn't move, and that doesn't have any effect on the timing. So I would suggest that the Libet effect is a sort of an illusion of time, just like the illusions of space that we know about from the various geometric illusions. So our experience of time shrinks and expands depending on the context in which it occurs. So this is the famous Ebbinghaus illusion. I hope you all agree that these two circles are exactly the same area. But when we stick these things around them, this one appears smaller and this one appears bigger, very strongly, simply because of the context in which they occur. So they're the same size? No, they're different sizes. And there's something similar is happening in our experience of time in the Libet experiment. So I don't think it tells us anything about whether we have free will or not, but it does tell about something about how we experience our actions causing things in the world. And indeed, you can create striking illusions along because of this effect. So in this case, you press a button, and a very short time later, there's a flash. And here's occasionally there's this very early flash here. And you go on practicing that, and they're pulled together in time. So after you practice this experience enough, if the flash is presented 45 milliseconds after you press the button, you experience it happening before you press the button. So you can really mess about with the temporal order of things simply by your experiences of your actions causing effects. So I think the Libet effect is an illusion of time which causes... in which causes and effects are bound together. Intentions are bound to actions, and actions are bound to consequences. And how we experience an action depends on its consequence. So in some sense, it's rewritten after the event. And this gives us an experience of responsibility. I caused this to occur, I am responsible for it. And we can distinguish in this way between actions that were intended or outcomes that were intended and outcomes that were accidental. And this sense of responsibility applies to other people's actions as well as our own. So, for example, there's now increasing evidence that this binding effect I showed to you also occurs when you watch somebody else pressing a button. Their actions are bound to the consequences. In other words, we experience the actions of other people in much the same way that we experience our own actions. Here's another experiment, not by me, regrettably. This is another EEG experiment. This is the error-related negativity. So if you're doing a task where you have to press buttons repeatedly, you occasionally make an error, and when you make an error, there's a big change in negativity at this point. So this is a difference between the correct ones here and the incorrect ones here. And the same happens, although a bit later in time, when you observe somebody else doing the task. When they make an error, you show this error-related negativity of the same form that when you make an error yourself. Interesting, these kinds of mechanisms where you represent other people's actions in the same way that you represent your own actions can lead to delusions of agency. They've been extensively studied by Daniel Wigner. And this is an example of such a delusion that happens in real life rather than the psychology lab. There's something called facilitated communication that was very popular a few years ago. It was originally developed for physically handicapped children who had difficulty moving their fingers to operate keyboards. And the facilitator would hold their hand and detect what they were trying to do and help them to do it. This began to be applied to children with autism. And strange things happened, so that uncommunicative children started writing poetry and things like this, and more distressingly, they started making accusations against their carers of abuse. It went to court in several cases, and experiments demonstrated that, in fact, it was not the child that was making the movements, it was the facilitator. But the point is, the facilitator sincerely believed that it was the child that was responsible for the actions. They did experiments like this, so you have the child and the facilitator, and unbeknown to them, they're actually being asked different questions, and the questions responded to were always those presented to the facilitator and not to the child. Now, I'm not saying that it never works, but I'm saying there are certainly many situations where this kind of illusion of agency has occurred. So you think somebody else is doing something which you're actually doing, Wegner has reproduced this in the lab, and he's also done it the other way around, where you think you're doing something which actually somebody else is doing. So our experience of agency is actually quite fragile, but it's very important nevertheless, because it relates to things like free will and responsibility. So as I already said, we can make a conscious distinction between deliberate and accidental consequences of action. And we make this distinction for ourselves and for other people. And even infants of 12 months can already make this distinction. So they get upset if the adult refuses to give them the teddy bear, but they don't get upset if the adult accidentally drops it on the way. And this is also the case that we feel more regret for actions over which we believe we have full control. So this is, again, part of this idea that the awareness of acting is very important for responsibility, regret, and the feeling of being an agent. So although the conscious experience may not have any immediate effect on these actions, it has a key role in creating things like social cohesion. And this is one, I think, of the major functions of consciousness, at least as it applies to awareness of being agents of our own actions. And the example of this is altruistic punishment. So I'm now briefly moving into neuroeconomics. So successful group interactions depend upon trust and reciprocity. And to maintain trust and reciprocity, we need to apply sanctions, known sometimes as altruistic punishment, to individuals who do not reciprocate, known as free riders. Here is an experiment from Ernst Fehr and Simon Geschter. This is a common goods game where you have four players who are given a certain amount of money, and they can put money into the central bank, and then it will be doubled and shared out between all four. So if everybody puts money in, so if you put money in, you lose a bit, but if everybody puts money in, everybody gains, and you get more and more money. So it should go up like this. But there will be inevitably someone in the group known as a free rider who realizes that they can gain from everybody else putting money in, and if they don't put money in themselves, they'll gain even more. And these free riders tend to appear, and as a result of this, everybody else says, why should I put money in to support this person? And the group cooperation goes steadily down in these two cases, as you might call it Thatcherism or something like that. You can then introduce altruistic punishment, which means that you are allowed to punish free riders, but it costs you money, so that's why it's altruistic. When you introduce the altruistic punishment, as here and here, the collaboration doesn't break down, and the amount of giving into the system continues steadily to increase. And interestingly, there's another experiment where they actually had two situations which you could either choose to go into the group which had sanctions or the group that didn't have sanctions. People started off by going to the group that didn't have sanctions, but by the end of the experiment, they had virtually all switched to the group that did have sanctions, so you got better cooperation. Now, what's the point of all that? The point of all that is that these sanctions are only applied when you believe the people are behaving of their own free will. So this is an experiment from my colleague Tanya Singer along the same lines, and this is about how the offers are. So a very fair offer is if you give someone half of your amount, a very unfair offer is if you keep it all for yourself, and then you could apply punishment or reward to these people, and obviously the more fair they were, the more reward they got, and the more unfair they were, the more punishment they got. So it didn't matter whether it was to you directly or to you observed it happening to somebody else, this one. But the lines across here was if you were told these people are simply reading off a sheet and doing what they've been told, even though they were giving or taking exactly the same amount of money, you didn't apply any punishment points. So it's critical for this kind of situation where to keep social collaboration going depends on punishment, that you believe that people are responsible for their actions. So even if free will is an illusion, it's one we desperately need to keep. So I'm saying that experience of action doesn't have any immediate effect, but it enables to make a conscious but post hoc distinction between actions which are deliberate or accidental, and this is very important for social cohesion. Now, in addition to being aware of performing an action, having an intention and doing something, We also have a vivid awareness of selecting between different options. I could do A or I could do B. So what's the value of this awareness? Does it enable us, for example, to overcome primitive selfish urges and choose the good option out of the various possibilities? This assumes, and I think many of us do assume, that unconscious processes are selfish rather than social. And the new evidence, I think, actually shows that our unconscious processes are mostly social and not selfish. We're much more embedded in the social world than we realize. And this is one of the things I think that's been revealed, one of the few things that's been revealed by brain imaging. So this is an experiment I did with Sarah Jane Blakemore, which was about a special kind of synesthesia that had recently turned up. These are people who say, when I see someone's face being touched, I feel it on my own face. And that was very exciting to brain imagers because it said, aha, and we know that there's a map in the brain of different bits of the body. So presumably, people with synesthesia, you would see different bits of the brain lighting up depending whether they see the person being touched on this face side or that side or the neck. And this is what we did. And this is showing an area of primary somatosensory cortex. This area lights up when the person in the scanner is touched here, and it also lights up when the person in the scanner sees somebody else being touched here. So they're sharing the experience, as it were. But the extraordinary thing was, as I said, this started because of people with synesthesia, but we obviously had a control group. This is the control group. So everybody, all of you, will show this effect, but unless you're synesthetic, you will not be aware of it. So in fact, we're sharing people's sensory experiences all the time without noticing it. This is a similar story in relation to action. You probably can't see this very well, but this is what the subject sees on the screen in front of them. He sees a hand, and he sees a number, which you probably can't quite see here, which can be one or two. So when that number is a one, you lift your first finger. When it's a two, you lift your second finger. And this is the reaction time. And then the hand you see on the screen has these clamps on the first and second finger. Your hand is still completely free. When you see that picture, your reaction time slows down. On the other hand, if you put the clamps on different fingers, it doesn't slow down. So again, you're automatically and unconsciously mirroring the possibilities of action from what you see in other people. So if I walk next to Peter, I will probably start limping. Yeah. So again, and we automatically and unconsciously imitate the movements of others. This is sometimes called the chameleon effect. And the more a person imitates us, you then go into a lab and you have people who are actually stooges who have been instructed to imitate you. The more they imitate you, the more empathic they think you are. And actually you'll give more money to charity after you have been imitated, even though it's not being asked for by the imitator. But this, of course, only works if you're unaware of the mimicry. If you're aware of the mimicry, then this is clearly a creepy person who should be avoided. But at the unconscious level, this is a very important part of social cohesion. And here's a particularly nice example of this kind of social cohesion. This is a natural experiment, as it were, done in the psychology department at Newcastle University, where in the common room there is an honesty box where you're supposed to put the money for the coffee and the milk. And of course, at the end of each week, there's less money in the box than was actually spent on the coffee and the milk. So they did a very simple experiment. On each week, they put a photograph above the box, which is either of flowers or a pair of eyes. And you don't need any statistics. You can see that when there's a pair of eyes above the box, people put in more money. Particularly these eyes, yes. This is completely irrational. No one's actually looking at you. And I slightly worry that this won't work anymore after all these lectures. Yeah? But that's again an example of how the social world actually makes us behave more socially, not more so. And this idea that our unconscious is selfish is probably completely wrong. So rational conscious, the question is, can rational conscious reasoning overcome automatic emotional processes in decision making? And I'm suggesting that actually it's the other way around. I can tell you about if there's time afterwards. that conscious reasoning is actually a way of being more selfish rather than being less selfish. Because we're very good at justifying our behaviour after it has happened. And it may be this is another key role for consciousness. It's not for deciding what to do, it's for justifying why you did it afterwards. And here's a very nice example of this from Per Johansson and colleagues, where he showed the participants, he had two piles of cards with faces on. So on each trial you're shown two faces of girls. You say, which one did you prefer? The cut packs are then put face down, and the one you just chose is pushed across the table, and you pick it up and look at it, and you have to explain why you chose that face. Now, the clever thing was that on 20% of the trials, through sleight of hand, using a conjurer, subjects were actually, the card that they were presented with, which they thought was the one they had just chosen, was actually the other one. And on 70% of these cases, they did apparently were not aware that the card had been switched, and then they proceeded to explain why they had chosen the one that they had not actually chosen. So this is an example of this post hoc justification. The experiment has more recently been repeated in a supermarket using jam and tea. Again, people are presented with two kinds of jam. They choose one using a reversible jar. They're then presented with the other one to explain why they liked it, and they then go ahead and do so. So again, this shows how important this is for justifying what we do, and it's rather less important for knowing what we did. The important thing is the justification. It's talking to other people. So through our rather weak ability to monitor our decisions about what to do, we can justify our behaviour to others. And another key function of consciousness is to enable us to discuss our behaviour with other people. And this discussion does actually affect people's behaviour. So here's another of my favourite experiments that's not by me. So they had two groups of subjects. One group is told, working on a strenuous mental task can make you feel tired such that you need a break before performing a new task. The other group was told, sometimes working on a strenuous mental task can make you feel energized and ready for further challenges. They were then given either a strenuous mental task or a less strenuous mental task. So this is the strenuous mental task here, the less strenuous here. And after they had finished it, they were given the stoop task, which is a difficult task where you make lots of errors if you're not careful. And you've got this striking result that the people who had been told working on a strenuous mental task makes you tired made more errors. And the people who'd been told working on a strenuous mental task energizes you made less errors. So simply talking about what effects performance of tasks has can change people's behavior. So again, and I think that's why understanding of concepts like free will and willpower, which is what I've just been talking to you about, these have cultural aspects which are generated by these sorts of discussions which consciousness of our actions enables us to have. So in other words, our ability to reflect upon our actions and discuss them with others, that's what I'm saying consciousness is, and that's what it's for. And in the long term, sharing introspections about decision making leads to cultural rules for making decisions both at the group level and at the individual level. So finally, I want to talk about perception. So far I've talked about our conscious awareness of action, doing things, making choices. What about that aspect of consciousness which is more normally emphasized, which is our experience of the sensory world of color and shape and so on? And these now are really my experiments where we're trying to show there is actually a value in being able to talk about our sensory experiences to each other. So the question we asked was, can the sensations of two people be combined to achieve optimal performance? So this is what I call social psychophysics. Here's Bahadur Bahrami, who led this experiment and has driven it in all sorts of directions since. So we have two people sitting together here, looking at screens, and this is what happens. I have to learn this by heart. This is a two-interval forced choice oddball contrast detection task, which means that you have two intervals. So these pictures appear on the screen one after the other. Each picture has these six stripy patches. In one of the pictures, one of the stripy patches is slightly different from the others because of the contrast being different. And you have to say which interval did this oddball contrast appear in. So two people do it, they make their decisions. If they disagree, if one says it was in the first interval and the other says it was in the second interval, they have a discussion, and then randomly one of them is chosen to give the results of the group discussion at the end of the experiment. And they're told whether they were right or wrong. And the results were very exciting, because what this shows is that this is the performance you would get if you chose the best person in each pair. This is the performance you get if you choose the group decision of each pair. And you can see the group decision is highly significantly better than the best person on their own. So there has been an advantage simply by them discussing with each other what they actually saw. You could ask the question, how do they deal with the discrepancy? They could, for example, they could toss a coin to decide who was right, in which case you would get the average of the two people. You could just learn which was the better person and always choose their response, in which case you would get just the best performer of the pair. And what we think is happening is something we call and weighted confidence sharing. That is to say, they have to tell each other how confident they are in what they saw, and then they choose the answer of the more confident person. And the confidence we can estimate from their psychophysical curve, we don't need to ask them. And there's a fairly simple mathematical model, which I won't go into because I don't understand it, which enables you to predict what would be the best, if they use this model, what would be the best performance you could get. So this is the sensitivity of each person and so on and so on. So the idea is that they say first not sure, second very sure, so they choose him. And this is the data. So the blue triangles squares and circles are the actual data of the pairs. This is the group benefit, that is to say, how much better is the group compared to the best person in the group. And this is the relative sensitivity. So at this end, you have two people who are equally good at the task. At this end, one person is much better than the other at the task. And the basic point is that our confidence sharing model, mathematical model, fits the data extremely well. This is the red line is the model, and the dotted blue line is the data. What this shows, which is quite interesting, is if the two people are equally good at the task, you get a big group advantage. But if one of them is much worse than the task, they actually do worse than the better member of the task, which is very interesting, and is something everybody knew, that you should be very careful in your choice of who to collaborate with. But the main point is that people can actually achieve the optimum result we believe is possible if they can share their confidences. Now, one question, of course, that was raised by the typically horrible referees that you get is that this might be confounded, because not only did they have a discussion, but they also were told whether they were right or wrong at the end. So we repeated the experiment, and half of the time they had a discussion and weren't told whether they were right or wrong. And another group of subjects, they were told whether they were right or wrong, but they didn't have a discussion. And this was, again, very striking. So this is the group advantage. And you can see there's a group advantage if you have a discussion, even though you're not told whether you're right or wrong. Whereas if you're only told whether you're right or wrong, there's no group advantage. And this is just how close you are to optimum possible performance. So this is very interesting, because this suggests that simply by having a discussion, you can get a more accurate picture of the world, even without any objective evidence other than that as to what really was out there, which I find quite exciting. Discussion is necessary, feedback is not. Now, obviously, so we're saying that people discussing their experiences together can produce a more accurate picture of the world, and this clearly depends upon their ability to introspect about their experience and, of course, to communicate it to other people. But what did our and this is all speculation, what did they actually say to each other in our experiment? And this is one of the examples. Advantages of working in Denmark, where this experiment was done, that we collaborate with these people who are semioticians and linguists, and they recorded everything that everybody said, which was 20 hours of video, and then transcribed it and looked at what words they used. And it was quite clear that they came up, each pair comes up with a scale for talking about how certain they are in their experience, and that each pair uses different words, though it comes to the same thing. And strikingly, I think only one pair ever used number and then gave it up. So they don't say, I had a confidence of 10. They use words. And these are examples of the words they used. So this is one pair, one end, translated from the Danish, saw it well, saw it all right, didn't see anything, only saw a blink. Another pair, sure, 55% sure, far from sure, and other things that I'm not going to read out. So, and there are two points to this. The more they discussed confidence rather than other aspects of the task, the greater their group advantage. And also the more quickly they came up with a small set of expressions for deciding levels of confidence, the greater the group advantage. So this is the people who had a small set of expressions for deciding confidence, and this is the group advantage. And these are people who never really quite homed in on expressions for deciding their confidence. So in other words, this seems to be fairly good evidence that what's going on here is people are talking about how confident they were in what they saw and what their decision was. And of course, it's not just that you have to say how confident you are, you have to also make sure that my level of confidence is the same as your level of confidence. You can't have someone who's very confident all the time. That has to be accounted for in this discussion. So by discussing their sensory experiences, two people can acquire a more accurate picture of the world. To do this, we need to introspect. In other words, we have to be aware of our experience and be able to develop some sort of common ground with others for talking about it. And this, I think, is another key role for consciousness. So to conclude, what is consciousness for? Awareness of action creates the experience of agency and responsibility for self and others. Awareness of choice permits the discussion of motivations and strategies for decision. And awareness of sensation permits the experience, the sharing of experiences and the generation of a shared reality. So in other words, consciousness allows us to create group knowledge and optimize group decision making. And interesting, this means that, contrary, I think, to Descartes, consciousness is not a private thing that is we cannot ever know about other people's consciousness. Consciousness is the one thing that we know about our brain activity which we can share with other people. We obviously can't share the unconscious bits. So conscious experience is not private, it's fundamentally social. It enables us to talk to people about our experiences, and this has created culture and the extraordinary advantages that human beings seem to have over other animals. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That was really wonderful. So all these government think tanks obviously have a function.
Well, there are interesting problems there, which I didn't talk about. There are other work. There's a lot of work on why group decisions don't work very well. One of the features of our experiment is that the people have to say in advance what they think the correct answer is, and then they discuss it. If people don't have to say what they think the correct answer is, then there is a great deal of room for being influenced by others inappropriately. So that may be another key story here. So I think the trouble with government think tanks is that they're often told what the answer is that they're supposed to get.
Well, thanks very much. Now, I'm sure many of you will have really interesting questions for Chris. Has he answered your question? What is consciousness for? He's given us some answers. Do any of you have any further questions for him? Who'd like to ask the first question? Yeah.
I'm not sure if Colin is aware that the philosophy in this organisation is really through group discussion. It's an oral tradition.
Yes.
What you've been saying seems to me to make me want to keep in a group and keep understanding through that broader method rather than through definitions. It's not a question, it's an observation.
Yeah. No, I think that's very... I mean, one of the big problems with all psychology experiments is either you discover something that everybody knew or they don't believe you. But I'm very pleased. Yes, I mean, I would certainly agree that group discussion is the wonderful thing that we can do and creates knowledge.
Yes.
I'm a little surprised you didn't include consciousness of the self in your list. And I wondered whether that was a deliberate exclusion or whether it's something that's impossible to do experiments on.
I guess it's partly very difficult to do experiments on. In a sense, when I talk about action, I'm talking about consciousness of the self in the sense that you're being conscious of what I did and why I did it. I'd not really gone into the idea of what is the self, or is it a narrative story? I'm quite interested. I have a friend called Thomas Metzinger, who's a philosopher in Germany, who believes there is no such thing as the self. And it's sort of constructed. I mean, certainly the sort of things I've been telling you about would suggest to me that ourselves are constructed again through conversations with other people. And myself is going to be slightly different depending on who I'm talking to at the time. So in that sense, it's a very malleable feature. But this is hand-waving, as you see.
I was thinking about the 300 milliseconds in the timings early on, and I was thinking how hard it is to swat a fly.
Yes.
And perhaps that's because a fly has a very small brain that works very quickly and doesn't have lots of consciousness.
Yes, I'm sure that's right.
So my question is, if we manage to achieve higher levels of consciousness, will we become slower and slower?
I think the higher levels of consciousness will certainly be slower and slower, but the clever thing about how the brain works is that we can leave all that stuff to the unconscious bit, which is still fast. But we have to be prepared to let go. I mean, this is what Star Wars is all about. Feel the force. Yeah.
Two things. You talked so, lit up so many ideas, but you went on while I was going, wow, about that idea, and then missed what you were saying next. But one of the things about the hand moving, I've always wondered, if you knock a cup off, say, you often catch it before you know that you've knocked it off.
Exactly,
and that's a marvellous thing. And the other thing is what somebody's just said is, for some reason, your thing on the brain has resonated with a man called David Bohm, who talked about small groups being the only way of advancing. And he said it was, I'm going on too long, he said it was by listening. If people really listen without judgment, though they might not get a result, something came in at a tangent.
No, I would agree with that. I mean, one of the things we obviously want to do with this paradigm, now that we've got it, is to explore ways in which groups break down. For example, we just published a paper where we gave testosterone to people doing this task, and the results were quite nice because the testosterone had no effect whatever on their individual performance. They were just as good at detecting the signal, but it eliminated the group advantage. And this seemed to be because they basically ignored what the other person said. These, of course, were all women, because there's no point in giving testosterone to men, I should say.
Where the testosterone level has fallen really quite dramatically. They obviously all listen to each other.
a long time ago, a very dear friend in this house spoke of happiness in relation to consciousness and expressed the idea that if a person claimed to be conscious and was not happy, alarm bells should be ringing. Could you comment on that, please?
I think happiness is almost more difficult than consciousness. There's one interesting experiment which is slightly evil, I think. or it can be used for that sort of purpose. Basically, if you want to make someone feel less happy, then what you should do is ask them how happy they are. So in some sense, introspecting about this kind of mental state seems actually not to be so good. You're more happy when you're not thinking about it. I mean, that's all I can say. And that's sort of the idea of being with the flow. As soon as you start thinking about yourself, it won't work anymore.
Yeah. Chris, tell us something about the Soon experiment, would you? Do you remember that one where they were saying 8 to 10 seconds before voluntary decision arises, their brain processes, which anticipate it?
This is basically a repeat of the Libet experiment using an MRI scanner. But it's different from the Libet experiment in one way. That is to say, in the Libet experiment, the instruction was lift your finger whenever you have the urge to do so, so that the decision was about when to lift the finger. In the experiment from John Dylan Haynes' lab in Berlin, the decision was, do I lift my left finger or my right finger? And they get the same result in the sense that they can predict from the pattern of brain activity which finger is going to be lifted about 6 seconds before it is lifted, which is way, way longer than the time at which the person reports wanting to lift it. My critique of that experiment would be, first of all, that their prediction is better than chance, but it's something like 60% rather than 50%. I think there are constantly shifting activities in the brain which make you attend more to the left side or to the right side, and indeed you can, we have done this, which is very messy. If you put ice cold water in one ear, people shift over to the other side, as it were. So you could bias people to lift their left finger more than their right finger by putting ice cold water. I can never remember which ear it is, but I think it's the right ear. So there are all sorts of biases that are constantly going on which determine whether you're more likely to lift your left finger or your right finger. And this might be sufficient to explain this result. And because it's only 6%, you could be measuring these slowly changing biases. It doesn't tell you about the other 40%, about whether you decide to go with the bias or not on this particular trial. So that would be my explanation of why you can see it so early. And people like Darren Brown obviously capitalize on being able to prime people to do things in this way. Conjurers know all about this much more than psychologists.
Thank you. Yes. I'm wondering if I can remember my train of thought because I'm thinking too much about it. But I'll have a go. I was quite intrigued by a sort of slightly off-the-cuff comment you made about Thatcherism. How that makes selfishness conscious. I think that's what you were saying.
Yeah. Well, it's a story about greed is good, I guess.
So that's, I think, something behind the culture we're now living in, which is more, I think, selfish and individualistic than social.
Yeah.
So that led me to wonder, right, so what might the next step be? What might the next step be? And that then led me to think about the hypothesis, I think it's fair to call it, that Alistair Hardy had about the evolutionary adaptive significance of religious experience, which seemed from the examples, I don't know how rigorous the experimentation is or anything, to people consciously becoming more social and more aware of their context. Mm-hmm. And that word conscience that you haven't really mentioned. So I'm wondering, is the next step something to do with becoming consciously social and connected, perhaps through that sort of experience? And is the notion of conscience connected to that?
No, I think that's right. As far as I understand it, the etymology of consciousness originally went with conscience and actually means something like co-science, i.e. common knowledge. So I think originally it was something that was shared rather than private. I think one of the things that I haven't really talked about, that we get an advantage from the more we discover about our unconscious biases, because to some extent we can take account of them. But the problem is that this can go either way. You can use them to, you can overcome your social biases, or you can overcome your selfish biases equally easily. And because we're so good at justifying our behaviour, we can come up with clever ideas about why it's good to make enormous profits, and so on, because it will trickle down, although no one has ever seen it trickling down, as far as I can see. So these are the sorts of stories we can tell. But from that point of view, that might be the sort of next step. There's something else I was going to say. I mean, I don't. Maybe this is. I could describe a neat experiment. Is this the one? No. I think it's about. Maybe it's not there. No, I will just describe it in words. A couple of people in the States did a very clever experiment on moral hypocrisy. And they were able to operationalize moral hypocrisy by taking someone into the lab and saying, right, there's another participant in the next room. There are two tasks to be done, but you can choose which task you do and which task he does. And people have this unfortunate tendency to choose the easier task for themselves and to justify why there's nothing wrong with doing that, which is where the moral hypocrisy comes in. So they then ask the question, which I'm sort of asking, is this because you make, is this your unconscious selfishness coming through that makes you behave like this? So they then did a classic psychology experiment using cognitive load, as it's called. So if you ask people to remember random numbers, that prevents them from using their conscious access to the other task. And basically what they showed is when you ask people to remember random numbers while doing this moral hypocrisy story, the moral hypocrisy disappeared. In other words, it was the conscious thinking about it that enabled them to be morally hypocritical. And if they were not allowed to think about it, they actually behaved in a more sociable manner. So that's an example of where the thinking was clearly used to justify selfish behaviour. But as you say, there's no reason whatever why the thinking shouldn't be used to justify social behaviour as well. And that would be, maybe that's what religion is partially all about.
Chris, that's very nice, because it maps absolutely onto what we understand about mindfulness and mindfulness meditation, because it keeps you right in the moment, so you can't do all this self-justification and distortion of moral values by thinking. Interesting.
Good morning. A question, well, obviously you've raised a whole lot of questions that we're not going to be able to cover this morning, but let me just raise an obvious one. Having attended a few conferences where the likes of Daniel Dennett and David Chalmers have talked about consciousness and the problems arising from a scientific viewpoint, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that the essential paradigm behind all this is that consciousness is created by something that we call the brain through the processes of the brain. And that's the fundamental paradigm through which most of science, at least, operates. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I guess. I'm not quite sure about I'm happy with the word created, but yes, most people would put it like that, yeah.
So it's, you know, the cart and the horse, really, the idea seems to be that, you know, if there isn't a physical brain, there is no consciousness. You will probably not be too surprised to hear that there may be different viewpoints on that. I would like to just, I can't remember an exact quote, but to give you a quote from something called the Isha Upanishad, which is at least 2,000 or 3,000 years old, where in fact it talks about exactly what you've been talking about this morning in terms of the brain's activity being one thing, and the apparent conscious experience being quite another. What it just says very briefly is the self runs ahead, the senses lag. So it makes this differentiation between, the words are different, of course, but it talks about the nature of consciousness itself as being a conscious resource of knowledge, if you like, and then the afterwash, if you like, of apparent personal experience, knowledge, apparent decision making, and so on. So it seems to me that there has to be a distinct, as always dealing with words, it's tricky because everyone tends to use the same words in different ways. But would you agree that one has to make a distinction between the illusion of personal awareness, personal doership, personal decision-making, and everything that we associate with me, and the nature of consciousness itself.
Yes, I'm not sure I'd have difficulty in talking about the nature of consciousness itself. I mean, two things that occurred to me while you were speaking was, first of all, this idea that the senses come behind. This fits very nicely with the current fashionable view of how perception works, which is sometimes called predictive coding or Bayesian inference, which is basically, it's the old-fashioned idea is it's a bit like a camera. The sensations come in and you interpret them. The new version is that you start with the interpretation and then you test it by seeing what sensations come in. So in a sense, your perception of the world is prior and it's adjusted by what happens, what comes into the eye and so on. So my particular way of putting it is that our experience of reality is a hallucination marginally constrained by reality, to capture the idea that it's most of it is inside rather than out there. Now, but I'm still thinking, of course, that the brain, that's how the brain does it. And I would be on the other, and so in that sense, I think without a brain, you wouldn't have this going on. On the other hand, I would certainly agree that the brain is not enough to explain our experience, but this is, in a sense, because I'm saying our experience depends critically on interaction with other people and other brains. And there's something like culture, which is out there, and will still be there when my brain is dead, which is very important for how I perceive the world. So in that sense, the brain is not enough. And also, of course, as I try to emphasize, our awareness of what we think we're doing is very, very fragile and usually wrong. So in that sense, our experience of ourself is removed from what's really going on.
Okay. We could probably have two more. Well, there are two hands. There's one there and there's one here. Sadly, I'm afraid we're going to have to bring the session to an end.
Well, I was never very good at science, and I suppose in trying to think of this in terms of brain function, that'll be a grapple. But something very simple seemed to emerge from what you said about that innate sense of altruism and connectedness, which seemed to be there, which seemed to be a universal something, quality. But somehow, when we began thinking, we all did that differently. So thinking seemed to cloud something or put something there when you were talking about the person in the other room, and when the thinking was prevented, or the way of thinking that because there was something else to focus on, that there seemed to be that natural connectiveness with allowing the other person to have what was best. But when we thought about what we'd like to do, we invariably chose the better or nicer part for ourselves. And I thought that was interesting.
Good. I mean, I guess that's a comment more than a question. I mean, I think one key point is that we are indeed, thinking does tend to mess things up. If we just do it by ourselves, we need to do it together.
Two comments, really. One reinforcing something you said. My wife and I both came from South Africa a long time ago, 50 years ago. It amuses us that when we get together with other South Africans, our voices go more South African. As you say, without any intention, we mimic. The other one is in the discussion group I belong to, of which I'm a member here. We discussed something about social interaction that relates closely. The situation when somebody else has made an unkind remark, now what do we do? Now, we've discussed this. There's an impulse to make an equally unkind remark in vengeance. But in discussing it, it's generally agreed in any group, I find, that it's better not to. Yeah. That either to say something that heals the situation or to say nothing at all. But that becomes reinforced by the discussion, which is something you mentioned. That's actually practical. It's actually happened here.
Yeah. Now, two comments to that. First of all, there is actually an experiment, so it must be true, showing that if you imitate someone's accent, there's communication is better. They presume they shouldn't notice. Yeah. But your second point is very interesting. There's currently a great deal of interest in something called the we mode. This is, again, going back to economics. So you can ask the question, what is best for me to do? And there are various options. But if you ask the question, what is best for the group for me to do, the options might be different. So I suspect one way of thinking about what you were just saying is that if we can switch to the we mode so that rather than maximising my gains, we maximise the group gains, this might be the kind of development that these discussions allow.
Well, I'm afraid we've got to end it there. But before we end, I must ask Chris the $64,000 question. There are many philosophies which see consciousness as the basis of the universe, and that, if you like, it's a transformation of this in some way that leads to the illusion that we're here, and so on and so forth. Do you feel that there is any scientific way of examining that, or do you think that it will always remain at a philosophical and experiential level?
I think there's no scientific way of examining that.
Okay, so it's going to be philosophical and experiential. Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming. It really has been an absolute delight. Certainly what I got from this is our deep embeddedness in the social group and the way that we transform ourselves to either partake of the group or to change our relationship with them, but also the impact it has on physical space, which I hadn't really thought about so much, as on mental time and attribution as well. I mean, a wonderful talk. So I'd like you all to thank Chris very much indeed for coming. Thank you.
That was absolutely delightful.